the youth. I read your book.
Here we go.
Would you like me to quote you? Ironically, the thing that people are most hungry for, meaning, is the one thing that science hasn't been able to give them.
Yeah.
Come on. It's like you're saying that science killed God. What if science simply revealed that he never existed in the first place?
I think we're going to need to get some air.
What?
And a few more of these.
Thank you. Whew. A little chilly out here.
Yeah, this is nice.
I got one for you.
What do you got?
Occam's Razor. You ever heard of it?
Occam's Razor. It sounds like some slasher movie.
No, Occam's Razor. Basic scientific principle. And it says, all things being equal, the simplest explanation has to be the right one.
Makes sense to me.
It's always more likely. Thank you.
You're
an all-powerful, mysterious God created the universe and then decided not to give any proof of his existence. Or that he simply doesn't exist at all. And that we created him so we wouldn't have to feel so small and alone.
I don't know. I couldn't imagine living in a world where God didn't exist. I wouldn't want to.
How do you know you're not deluding yourself? I mean, for me, I need proof.
Proof. Did you love your father?
What?
Your dad, did you love him?
Yes. Very much.
Proof.
This is common atheistic super, it's utterly superficial when you really begin to see how this stuff begins to work together. Like, atheism is like the lowest hanging fruit on the intellectual tree. And mental Christianity is just a little bit above it. Because it's easy for each other. And this is where most of the battle lies between the superficial atheists and superficial Christians that don't know and have not been taught how to deal with the myriad of ideas that are out there in the world. And so that's part of what I want to do is help with that. The page that has what is science? Basically, science has two forms to it. There's the how things work kind of science. That's what has given us everything in this room. The study of nature and how we can pull the creation apart and put it back together to make useful things. It's observable, it's testable, it's repeatable. Doesn't matter who you are, where your laboratory is, that if you mix two parts hydrogen, one part oxygen, you're going to get water. It has nothing to do with belief systems. And it's called operational science. It's empirical, it's verifiable, it's observable, testable, and repeatable. And this is critical. This is the critical part of that. The other kind of science is called historical science. And it is essentially forensic. The events of history are not observable. In most cases, they're not testable. And in most cases, they're not repeatable. Sometimes. Imagine Greek fire. The Greeks had this way of, they had a chemical mixture that they would catapult it onto enemy ships, and it, like in a clay jar, and it would break, and it would explode in flames. If it got in the water, it got even hotter. It was an amazing weapon of war. And nobody could figure out. I think probably somebody has been able to figure it out, but here's the thing with history. Even though we duplicate the effects of Greek fire, that doesn't mean we have what they have. We have something that looks like it fulfills all the criteria. You put it, you mix up the chemicals, put it in a clay pot, launch it, it breaks, it bursts into flames, so it gets in the water, it gets even hotter. But that doesn't mean that's the same, exactly the same. There is nothing from history.
Here.
I have day one and day three.
This is a separate one.
So, even though we can approximate something from history, that doesn't mean that that's what they did. Building the pyramids is a huge one. Some people think they've got it figured out. It's still in general, the general consensus, we got no idea how they did that. We got no idea how they moved stones across a mountain range when we can't even lift those stones from the best cranes available today. We have no idea. Oh, aliens did it. You know, people come up with all kinds of speculations of how. And see, this is part of presuppositions. If you start with Adam and Eve and 100% brain power, and we are now in a advanced state of deterioration, then they knew how to do stuff that we can't do today. Even separate from supernatural or aliens or any of that kind of stuff. So this forensic kind of science, this is very limited by the scientific method. Because we can't observe it, we can't repeat it, and we can't test it. We can maybe get close, and the further, and this is, you know, where we have relics and fossils and things, we can do some limited kind of thing. I remember when I was a kid, we'd watch these National Geographic specials, and they had held up this piece of pottery and said this had something to do with their religious worship. Well, it's like 10 years later, it turned out, well, that was the grocery list. Yeah, something completely, totally separate from everything, every relic, every icon, everything was something to do with their religion. And it is kind of funny. But that kind of stuck with me all this time. And so we have relics and fossils, and those are hints of the things, but if you have a rock, and I got a socket side of a ball and socket joint from a dinosaur, and I'm going to take this to Linda's lab, and she's going to date it. How old is this rock? Well, you don't know. The dinosaur presupposition has got to be at least 65 million years old, so you're going to start running your dating tests, and you're going to have a date that says like 4,900 years old. You're going to have another date that might say 100,000 years old. Another date that may be 64 million years old, or another one 70 million. You're going to throw away that 4,000 year old date. It's just absolutely wrong. Even though you run the same test over and over, and it keeps giving out the same number. But it's wrong, because your presupposition says, no, we're looking for a date around 65 million years. And that they do that. There's a great series by a guy named Don Patton. And the first couple, there's on what is creation science, and he has what is science. And there's ones on fossils and the whole thing. There's about a dozen parts to it. But he just goes through and documents all kinds of stuff about problems. And even, and I'm going to show you a couple slides here in a second, that where they even admit that there's problems. The agenda sets the interpretation. And this is one of the things with historical science, is it requires interpretation. Well, interpretation is completely dependent on the beliefs of the interpreter. And the beliefs of the interpreter are controlled by his presuppositions. And so we're three philosophical steps away from a conclusion, all of which bias the outcome. John Rennie, Scientific America, July 2002. I actually wrote a letter back. It was 15 answers to creationist nonsense. I wrote him a letter and said, if this is really the best you got, you just made my job a whole lot easier. Because it was weak. But this is what they said in the, this is in the opening editorial, and I have this issue. The central tenet of modern science is methodological naturalism. It seeks to explain the universe purely in terms of natural mechanisms.
God.
Any form of supernatural causation is excluded. It's not even considered. But I left something out here that he included. Does the Big Bang fit that?
It can't.
How can we do tests, Big Bang tests? I just kidding. How can we do T-Rex tests? We can't. How can we... actually, that's not exactly true, because there's a whole problem with it. I'd write down dinosaur soft tissue. That's a big deal out there. But in terms of observed, anybody observe anything about evolution? Evolution, we'll see in a minute, is completely unobservable. If it takes millions of years for one kind of creature to turn into another kind of creature, who's going to observe it?
And all that fallacious information that came out of, I don't know if it was the 50s or 60s, about putting chemicals and energy together and coming up with life.
Right.
In the lab,
that's the Uri Miller experiment.
Yeah.
Where they produced amino acids. It's,
and that was all fallacious.
Verge of life. Yeah, first time I read that, some like junior high biology, and I was looking through there, they had what they thought was the chemicals in the early earth, and they'd pass it through this thing, and they'd shoot it with lightning, and these amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, would come out. And then later, I thought that was pretty, I read the list of chemicals, and I thought, there's one piece that's missing. There's hydrogen and all this kind of stuff. But there was one thing that was missing, and that's oxygen. So what happens when you mix hydrogen, oxygen, and lightning? So they could not allow oxygen in that mixture. And then it came, all the tricks they had to do, because the entire process could destroy amino acids faster than it could create them. So they had to build a trap so that the amino acids could escape the system, and then they'd collect them outside. They didn't cycle back through, because if it created amino acids, and this is like several iterations, this experiment was fallacious. But it was based on their presuppositions of how, there is no God, and we're here. So we have to explain it somehow. And this was the Enlightenment Project. This is what the Enlightenment was all about. To find that way, there is no God, we're here. There was a theory of evolution 100 years before Darwin. But nobody believed that it would actually work. But Darwin is accused often of plagiarizing his grandfather, because his grandfather had written about evolution. And so Charles borrowed some of that stuff. So it was not new to him. It had been in the works, because there is no God, we're here. Evolution is the only way it's going to work. To start from chemicals and end up with people, there has to be these step-by-step things. They can't just pop into existence.
Dinosaurs are obvious. Evident, the fossils.
Yes. And it's, where do these massive creatures come from? And one of the ones, I think, is what is science? There's two parts. One of them, he goes into the what is observable, testable, repeatable. Nothing about the early universe or the early Earth is observed or tested. It doesn't work. And so, I got a quote here at the bottom. Evolutionists have physics envy. They tell the public that the science behind evolution is the same science that sent people to the moon and cures diseases. It's not. The science behind evolution is not empirical, but forensic. Because evolution took place in history, its scientific investigations are after the fact. No testing, no observations, no repeatability, no falsification, nothing at all like physics. And I think this is what the public discerns, that evolution is just a bunch of just-so stories disguised as legitimate science. And this is in the GeoTimes journal, a geology journal.
And so what Granny is claiming, and all that you'll hear Gordon Stein in the Bonson Stein debate talk about how God's not, that science is atheistic. And what he's talking about is this methodological naturalism. We're not looking for the truth of history, but a purely naturalistic explanation. But the claim is, and this is what they tell the people, that it's observable and it's testable when it's actually not. So this is Colin Patterson. He is the late Colin Patterson. He was the head of the Natural History Museum in London. World's biggest collection of fossils. He wrote a book on evolution, and somebody wrote him and asked him how come he didn't include any transitional forms in his book. He talked about them, but he didn't include any pictures. He goes, there aren't any. In charge, atheist, evolutionist, in charge of the biggest fossil collection in the world, and he says there are no transitional forms. And you asked me if I would include pictures. Well, in the reply back, he said that would mislead the people. Because there aren't any. If I'm going to include pictures, then I would be misrepresenting the science. But anyway, he said this in his book, Evolution. The history of evolution is unique and unrepeatable. Like the history of England. This part of the theory that evolution, assuming evolution has occurred, is therefore a historical theory about unique events, and unique events are, by definition, not part of science. Like a miracle. They're not there. Miracles are unique events, for they are unrepeatable and not subject to test. And yet, this head of Scientific America is saying we're about using observable, repeatable tests to discover the history of the universe. And it's just not there. And these contradictions are everywhere. And it takes somebody like me and Don to pull them together because these aren't in textbooks. I didn't include one, but there's a head woman that testifies, Eugenie Scott, testifies in court cases where the school districts are deciding whether or not to include problems with evolution. And she said that's utterly pointless because there are no problems with evolution. That is what is the public face of evolution. There are no problems. But behind the scenes, the real scientists, the real people doing the real work, in fact, in November of 2016, the Royal Academy of Sciences in London called a big meeting. And I didn't bring the book. The keynote speaker listed the top five questions that evolution has not answered. And the whole point of the conference was Darwinism is dead. We need a new theory. There is no God. We're here. Darwinism is dead, so we need a new theory. And these were professional, real scientific evolutionary biologists. And he lists out 24 questions. His keynote address was on the top five. And one of them is the origin of novel body parts and body forms. Darwinism can create nothing new. That is the science. And it's a big problem behind the scenes. But what students get, evolution is a fact, there are no doubts, every real scientist believes in evolution. And there, because we're talking about thinking. Go the wrong way. So, the second area, and by the way, these methods apply to anybody that is promoting teachers do it. And they're going to use one of these methods to convince students of whatever it is that they're trying to teach. It's not just Christians. We became the ones who are best at it because we've been doing it, explaining Christianity. One of the histories of that is that in the early Roman Empire, it was illegal to be a Christian. Mm-hmm. If you did not declare that Caesar is Lord, you're an enemy of the state. Best citizens always pay their taxes. They don't speed. They don't get tickets. In the empire. But they had one. They said, there's another king. That's in Acts. There are those who have come, turned the world upside down, saying there is another king above Caesar. And that was treason. But sometimes in their court case, and there was rumors, because one of the things that the Christians, it was common in the Roman Empire for people to dispose of babies at the city dump. Why? Or just leave them out on the doorstep to die. And the Christians would go around and gather them up. And then there was these things about communion, eating flesh and drinking blood. You know what they're doing with those babies, don't you? The rumors going around. And so it became necessary to explain what Christianity really was. What do we mean by eating flesh and drinking blood? And that kind of stuff. And so this was the birth of Christian apologetics. To explain Christianity. And so, as with everything else, it becomes more specialized and more compartmentalized, just like all the fields in science, or talking about engineering earlier. There's 50 categories of engineers and all kinds of subcategories. And so apologetics kind of went the same way. Some became more specialized. Some became very proficient at the evidence. And by evidence, it means scientific and historical evidence for Christianity. Then the second one, which was more birthed at the beginning, because they didn't have science then. They had some history, but they didn't have science like we think of it. And so it was more reasoned, rational based. And that's where the apology of Aristides the philosopher comes in. Also the traditional arguments. The argument from design, the argument from called cosmologic, the cause and effect, that you can't be having causes and effects backing up forever. There has to be a first cause. And actually, Aristotle, another atheist, was the first one to say that. He called it the prime mover. Somewhere that they never connected that prime mover should be worshipped, whoever that was. It was a philosophical kind of academic debate. And so the traditional arguments are birthed. And then the third one, which is where we're going to spend, which is the bigger picture of this class, is that presuppositional method of apologetics. And it is revelational. It uses transcendent objects, things that don't exist. There are things that don't exist in space and time. They have no connection to the material world, except through us. Beauty, justice. We can't go out and dig up a pound of justice. It's a transcendental, and I'll spend some more time on that probably next time. And it does a worldview analysis. These most basic beliefs. If you start with your worldview, can you get to the things that we take for granted? Can you get to science?
If you start with the atheistic worldview and work consistently up, you cannot get to science. Yet they claim that as their most valuable tool. And one of the early Enlightenment philosophers named David Hume wrote a comment on, he wrote a piece called I'll think of it in a minute, but he said one of the things science's most valuable features is predicting the future. If we take hydrogen and oxygen and mix it together, there's a future out there. And one of the things he said is that the human mind cannot know the future. We cannot know if we mix hydrogen and oxygen. We've done it a billion times. It always produces water. But we cannot know that that billion and first time is going to make water. It is beyond human knowledge. The future is a barrier. And so it caused a real stir among the budding scientists. And they were called natural philosophers. Actually, science was birthed in the church. And they were called natural philosophers. They studied God's creation. And they had the saying that they were thinking God's thoughts after Him as they studied the creation. But they started with this idea that the God of order and creation made things. He made laws and ordained that the physical universe should obey those laws. And because of that, we can study the creation and come up with how the creation works. So it was a massive leap, but yet the Enlightenment philosophers, that's the dark ages of faith, which I want to talk about that here in a minute. The dark ages of faith. Now we're in the age of reason. That was Thomas Paine's book, because he was an Enlightenment philosopher also. And so these three methods are, no matter where you go in the world, people use these in one form or another to teach their classes. This guy, Thomas Shea, is the editor of the Journal of Geological Education. He said about loss, the concept is anachronistic, out of time, that's outdated, in that it originated at a time when the Almighty was thought to have established the laws of nature and decreed that nature must obey them. It is a great pity for the philosophy of science that the word law was ever introduced. Because the word law implies a lawgiver. All of human experiences know that laws come from a lawgiver. And if you're an atheist, they hate that. They'll use it because it's convenient and everybody knows it, but they hate the idea. And this guy just came out and said it. So I'm going to shift to the day two. I'd say on the day one. Where is it? Towards the end in the definition section, number D, page 3, it's on day 1, and I want to focus on faith. And through this,
Day 1 or day 2?
Day 1, on page 2. Section D on faith.